Hey, I'm Vermont Edition producer Daniela Fierro. The podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Michaela Lefrak. The inpatient psychiatric unit at Central Vermont Medical Center in Berlin has closed its doors for good. And this comes as part of a series of cuts to patient care announced in November by the University of Vermont Health Network, actions aimed at saving money and complying with budget orders from the Green Mountain Care Board. The Green Mountain Care Board said they made significant efforts to preserve and even enhance mental health capacity at CVMC. But after a year that saw the unit reduce capacity from 15 patients down to 8 because of staffing issues, the decision was ultimately made to close the psychiatric unit entirely. There are a lot of moving parts here. Science and Health reporter Lexi Krupp has been following this issue and published a story this week after speaking with former patients who had sought care from the unit at one point in their lives and are now raising concerns about where they'd have to go if they need help again in the future. Lexi Krupp, thank you so much for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Lexi, let's start with the core question here. Why did CVMC decide to close its psychiatric unit?
So you mentioned this, but in the past 2 years, the unit there lost several psychiatrists, and the hospital couldn't replace them. They ended up hiring temporary doctors to staff the unit, and as part of that, they had to reduce their patient capacity. So that was the case for the last year. And the unit was busy. Most days it was full. And they cared for about 350 patients in all last year. That was with that reduction in patient capacity. Then in November, UVM Health Network announced all of these cuts to patient services. And we talked about this on the show a few months ago. And the behind the scenes here gets a little wonky, but we have this state regulator in Vermont called the Green Mountain Care Board. They're responsible for reviewing hospital budgets. And they told a bunch of hospitals that they are not going to approve all the increases those hospitals wanted for this year. The term they use here is called net patient revenue. That's the money that the hospital gets from providing patient care. And for Central Vermont Medical Center in particular, they said, you can still grow, but at a 6% increase from last year, not the 12% or nearly 12% that the hospital had asked for. So the hospital, you know, had budgeted for this bigger increase, and they're like, we're not going to get it. So they said, we have to make cuts to patient services. And they looked at all of those. They looked at the financials, the patient numbers, and they decided we're going to cut our psych unit. And I talked to the president of the hospital, Anna Noonan, about this decision.
So smaller services with higher loss was part of the criteria. So we had a pretty significant loss in psychiatry. That's not uncommon.
Last year, at that reduced capacity, they lost almost $3 million on the unit, according to hospital data.
Okay, so what kind of impact is this closure having?
Well, I talked to several former patients, family members, and staff about this, and this is a big deal. The unit had a pretty small number of beds when looking at the state as a whole, but it was the only place in central Vermont where anyone in a mental health crisis could go and get hospital-level care. You can still go to the emergency department at Central Vermont Medical Center if you are in a crisis, but you'll have to be transferred if you need a bed. So patients are going to have to travel farther and wait longer to get the care they need. And I think another big deal for a lot of the people who are patients there is that it was this place they knew that they could go when they were really sick. It was close by. And I think when you're in a crisis, that's really important. So I spoke with Karen Curley about this. She's the director of intensive care services at Washington County Mental Health Services. They're sort of like the emergency responders for mental health. And she actually brought up, she was in touch with a client this week who is in distress. They could definitely use hospital care. They had been a patient at CVMC at the inpatient unit before. And having to go to another hospital is just a really big barrier for them.
the individual feels afraid and overwhelmed and anxious in doing that. So that just is an example from yesterday.
Well, Lexi, given everything we've heard to this point, what are the other resources available in Central Vermont now? And again, other than going to the emergency room?
Yeah. So for any mental health emergency, people can always call 988. And then Washington County Mental Health Services has a 24/7 phone line. They also have an urgent care center in Montpelier that's open Monday through Friday. And they do have an overnight program for people in a mental health crisis. It's called Home Intervention. They have 4 beds. That's if they have enough staff to cover them. And it's not a replacement for hospital care, but it is seen as a hospital diversion program. And I asked Karen if they anticipate an increase in demand.
Yes. Yeah, I can absolutely say a whole hearty yes to that. We've already been experiencing it. We are absolutely feeling that stress and that pressure. If you hear it in my voice, it's a bit overwhelming and daunting. And yes.
Wow. So, you know, that's reflected in some, you know, response that we're getting from some of our listeners. We got this email from a former nurse and director, Paul, who wrote in and said, I'm a former nurse and director of the CVMC inpatient psychiatric unit. The closure of the unit represents the single greatest failure of leadership in the history of Central Vermont Hospital. It is a complete abandonment of the principles of a community-based hospital and is morally reprehensible. I strongly encourage people to contact our government representatives to help hold the hospital leadership accountable. Those are some very strong words, Lexi. I mean, is this the kind of reaction you're hearing from people around the community there?
Yeah. And, you know, definitely contact your government leaders. It's definitely a question of, like, what power they have. You know, can state officials tell the hospital they need to reopen this unit? I'm not sure they have that sort of jurisdiction. But yeah, the, you know, powerful words we just heard, and definitely this, you know, is really going to impact people's lives.
Yeah, you know, we're going to get into some of the issues surrounding the options that are available in the next block. We do have a caller on the line from Burlington. Robert is with us. Hi, Robert. You're on Vermont Edition.
Hi. So isn't this the facility that was built after Hurricane Irene and the raging Winooski River in Waterbury essentially destroyed our state hospital in Waterbury? And does this mean that the only state hospital we have is essentially the Brattleboro Retreat and there's just nothing else?
Lexi, can you
and
talk
about it? It's not even owned by the state. It's
right.
Yeah, let me this is a little confusing. There is the Vermont Psychiatric Care Hospital. That's different from Central Vermont Medical Center, their inpatient psychiatric unit there. And the big difference is that Vermont Psychiatric Care Hospital is sort of the highest level of need. So patients are not there voluntary. They're involuntary patients, and they have really high staff to patient ratios. So I made this distinction, but it's subtle. The CVMC is the only place that anyone can go for hospital care. You can voluntarily go there, say if you have suicidal ideation or whatever sort of crisis you're in. There is still the Vermont Psychiatric Care Hospital nearby, but it's not a place that anyone in Vermont can go to and get care.
I also feel like, Robert, thank you for the call, by the way, from Burlington. Lexi, I feel like part of the problem here, too, is that geography matters. Your location, your access to something like this. If you're in a mental health crisis, you may not be able to get yourself somewhere very easily, especially if you have to drive quite a distance away. Is that a lot of the problem that you're hearing about when people talk about the closure of this unit?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, right now, there are some stats on this. If for a mental health patient in an emergency department in Vermont, about 40% wait more than 24 hours for a bed. So they're stuck in the emergency department because there's not a bed available. You can go to Brattleboro. You can go to UVM Medical Center in Burlington, in Rutland. Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon has, and Springfield Hospital as well. They all have these inpatient psychiatric units. But yeah, that's far if you're living in Montpelier. And I think it's really hard if, you know, if family or friends want to visit, or someone like Karen Curley with Washington County Mental Health Services, to be able to have that in-person, you know, visitors, which is really important with psychiatric care. It just makes it that much harder. Yeah.
We have Carrie on the line from Montpelier. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Mitch. Thank you for taking my call. I have personally been to the psychiatric unit at the hospital 3 times, and they have literally saved my life. Mm. So I am very emotional about this decision to get rid of the third floor. 2 times I went when I was suicidal and 1 time for alcoholism, and they have group therapy. They have individual therapy. The staff is fabulous. And I have finally gotten sober. I'm 8 months sober now. And I wouldn't have been able to do it without the help I got on the third floor. So it's a real tragedy, in my opinion. And I'm sure I speak for a lot of other people that have been up there too.
Carrie, I'm very
great resource.
I'm very happy to hear that you're 8 months sober. Good for you. I am curious about the follow-up care. You know, it sounds like you said this place saved your life. Were you able to stay in touch with the people who helped you? Was there any kind of follow-up, even if it was just a phone call or something, to find out how you were doing? And is that a loss here, too, that follow-up won't be available now?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely a loss, because I always got follow-up calls. I made some really good connections with people and some good friends there that really, really helped me and turned my life around.
Carrie, I want to thank you very much for the call and for sharing your story with us. You know, it takes a lot of courage to do so, and certainly I hope that you can find the help you need if you need it in the future. And Lexi, I imagine that's something else you're hearing about too, folks that have been through this before. You know, you break your leg, you get put in a cast, eventually the leg hopefully heals correctly. But mental health care is different. People may experience another crisis at another point. I wonder if that's what you're hearing about too, is this idea that, you know, you can't just have it be magically fixed. There may be future need.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, you know, patients who are going there, you know, whenever they are in crisis and have been there before. And I think, you know, a lot of people talked about how, you know, your brain is no different than your leg, no different than your heart. If you have a heart attack, you know, they're, you know, you go to the hospital, they're not going to say, oh, well, like, go to this other cardiac unit. And I think, you know, for people in a mental health crisis, this sort of service, it's an emergency, and this is how you get care. So, I think this unit certainly did see people who had been there several times, and, you know, just like an oncologist, where if, you know, you're a cancer patient, you might need to go to the hospital several times when you're at your sickest.
Yeah. I mean, this gets into issues of the way we view mental health and mental health care in this country, maybe everywhere. Again, you know, I just feel like it's sometimes something you can't see that isn't necessarily physical that gets the short shrift here.
Yeah. You know, and I think, I mean, it was interesting to talk to different people who wanted to remain anonymous, or, you know, were willing to say, yes, this is my name and I needed care at the psych unit there. There's definitely a big stigma in a way that, you know, wouldn't be if you were a patient at another unit on the hospital. So that is very much still something, you know, we deal with today.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, Lexi. Briefly, I wanted to ask you this because that absolutely sparked my next question here. As a reporter, and you cover science and health issues all the time, but was this difficult for you? How did you reach out to people and get them to share these very personal and difficult emotional stories?
I was really lucky. I reached out to a couple people on the inpatient psychiatric, patient advisory committee at the hospital. They had written a public letter in a newspaper. I spoke with Representative Ann Donahue there. She's part of that committee. And then another person, Liza Ewald, who had been a patient, and she had actually put out a note on Front Porch Forum and on Facebook saying, "Hey, I'm speaking to this reporter. If anyone else has a story they want to share, please let me know." And I was connected to a couple people that way. So she did the hard work for me. I also spoke with some people at the National Alliance for, I think it's NAMI, mental illness maybe. So that's how I found folks to talk with.
Well, we really appreciate your reporting on this, Lexi Krupp. And if you're just joining us, we are talking about the decision by Central Vermont Medical Center in Berlin to shut down its inpatient psychiatric unit. Today, we're discussing the impact the closure is having on the state. It is the only psychiatric unit in Central Vermont that treats patients who are going through a mental health crisis and receive hospital care. And joining us now is Dr. Lisa Catapano-Friedman, the medical director at the Memory Clinic in Bennington. She is also president of the Vermont Psychiatric Association. And Dr. Catapano-Friedman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Catapano-Friedman, you are based in Bennington. I'm wondering what the landscape of people seeking mental health care looks like there right now.
Well, the landscape of people seeking mental health care is in many ways in itself unchanged. However, what's available to them has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller over the years. It already was a disaster. And now it is even going to be, it's already had an impact, even more of a disaster.
Well, to put some perspective on this here, you moved to Vermont in 1993, as I understand it. What was the availability of mental health treatment like then compared to now?
Okay, it was actually 1991, but that's okay.
Sure, early 90s.
when I moved here, it was basically to take over the outpatient psychiatric practice of somebody who was moving to Florida. And I joined a group that had several other practitioners, psychologists, somebody who became a child psychiatrist. There was an inpatient unit at the hospital in Bennington. And so, of course, there was a psychiatrist for that. There was the Community Mental Health Center, which, of course, still exists. And there was a psychiatrist for that. And in fact, more than one psychiatrist working there. There were other psychiatrists also in private practice in the community. So it was pretty well supplied. And we had an inpatient unit, about 15 beds, that was available when we needed to hospitalize a patient. All of that has disappeared since then. So that in the entire county of entire Bennington County, which I believe has a population of around 40,000, the Community Mental Health Center is there serving the chronically mentally ill, and they have a psychiatrist. They have tried to recruit another psychiatrist for years, have not been able to. There is no inpatient unit. I have a very small psychiatric private practice. As I said, I'm the medical director of the Memory Clinic, which focuses largely on dementia. I also am the psychiatrist for what is now called Vermont School for Girls, used to be Bennington School, which is a residential school for highly traumatized girls who have significant mental health needs. That has gotten larger and considerably more needy. And in the rest of the county, there is another psychiatrist in full-time private practice who does a very selective kind of practice, also often not taking insurance, so very limited kinds of patients can access that practice. And again, there is no place for any psychiatrist in this county to hospitalize a patient if they need to.
Well, I have to wonder then, and this may be a difficult question to answer because there's probably a lot of components to this, what has led to this dearth of availability for psychiatric care?
It's a combination of things. When you start to close psychiatric units, which the local hospital did in 1998, you discourage psychiatrists from wanting to be here because we need those units to be able to serve our patients adequately. We need inpatient services. There are plenty of other places for psychiatrists to go. They're already battling for the fact that reimbursement by insurance companies, particularly, is lower in Vermont and lower for psychiatry than in other specialties, despite the 2008 Parity Act, which has unfortunately not been enforced. So there are plenty of other places that are appealing for psychiatrists and potential psychiatrists to go. There is only one place, and that's UVM, which has training. Residency training for psychiatrists. Now, unfortunately, Central Vermont was one of their main sites for the experiences for these psychiatric residents to have, and they now can't have that. That's going to make it even less appealing for people to come to Vermont to learn to be a psychiatrist, basically. And what often happens when people do whatever residency training they're doing, whatever specialty, they get attached to where they are. They set down roots, they start to have families, and they stay there. We're not seeing that happening because, first of all, training here is less and less appealing because there's now even less experience to have, much more frustrating because there's now a dearth of places to hospitalize a patient, and then the economic issues on top of it. It's like, why be in Vermont?
I'm curious about those economic issues, and you're talking about Vermont specifically, but maybe I'm wrong here, but I can't imagine that it's a whole lot better in other states around the country. Is this an American problem because of the way we fund our healthcare system, insurance issues, et cetera? Or is Vermont just not getting the job done compared to other states, in your view?
I think it's a combination of things. I mentioned the Mental Health and Substance Abuse Parity Act, which is a federal act of 2008, which basically decreed that psychiatric services were to be paid in the same way as other specialty services in terms of time spent and the kinds of complexity. That act has not really been enforced, and part of that enforcement could and should happen on the part of states. If insurance companies are not paying commensurately, as that act decreed they should, insurance commissions in states can act upon that, basically, in a sense, threaten insurance companies with their ability to sell their insurance here. So that has been part of it. Funding in general has been a part of it, whether it's how states choose to delegate the funding they get. Much of that funding is federal. It's a complexity of things. Why psychiatry has always been sort of the poor cousin financially in terms of reimbursement. Part of the reasons that psychiatric units give in closing, as Central Vermont did, is that they're not big money makers. And partly they're not big money makers because they're not paid accordingly, equally to other specialties.
Well, as the president of the Vermont Psychiatric Association, your organization released a statement that opposed the CVMC unit closure. In the statement, it says public health research indicates that an optimal level of mental health services requires at least 35 inpatient psychiatric beds per 100,000 population. I don't know if you have these numbers right at your fingertips,
I
doctor,
do.
but what's the ratio now?
About 12. Now that Central Vermont closed, about 12 beds per 100,000 population.
What kind of impact does that have?
Well, I've already, we were already in big trouble. You mentioned, and you were very much, everything you had said before was very much on point. And it was mentioned that 40% of patients needing inpatient psychiatric care wait more than 24 hours in an emergency room for a bed. That 20, more than 24 hours is not 25 or 26 hours. It has been weeks.
Weeks.
And that's devastating. It's devastating for the patient. It's devastating for the emergency room. I've had several patients in the last couple of months, some of whom have been 2 weeks in an emergency room waiting for an inpatient bed. And some of those patients, in fact, all of them, have been very difficult to manage in emergency rooms. They're very disruptive. The emergency rooms try to keep them well-supervised and in rooms that are considered safe. Nonetheless, I've had very suicidal patients, very psychotic patients who have literally taken the rooms apart, trying to find something to either injure themselves or somebody else, because some of them have been homicidal. And then what has happened when they have finally gotten an inpatient bed is that 3 days later, they're discharged. They might have gotten in that interim one injection of some medication that sedated them, but they never got treatment. They never got medications changed or instituted. And when I spoke recently to one of the admitting psychiatrists, they acknowledged they're under a lot of pressure. They're being told, but there are more people waiting. There are more people waiting in emergency rooms. You've got to get these people out of the bed, discharge them. That's awful care. It's not care.
Yeah, and it's putting such stresses on the entire system. Let's go to the phones. We've got Xenia on the line from Barrytown. Hi, Xenia. You're on the line.
Hi. I have a variety of experience with the mental health system, but most on point, I worked for Washington County Mental Health for a number of years, including at the hospital diversion program that was described earlier, the home intervention program in Barry City. And as an immediate good step to improving the mental health system in Vermont, that program needs to be replicated all over the state. And the community mental health centers need to be much better funded. The HI program was about half the cost as any hospitalization, and was much more individually focused. I had to retire for health reasons, but it was very much person-centered, and the treatment programs were designed with the person and what they said their needs were and what helped them and stuff. And it was much more homey, and it was sometimes if somebody needed to be taken to their home to visit their dog, we would do that.
Xenia, I want to give Dr. Catapano-Friedman a chance to respond to this here, and specifically what you're talking about with community health centers, and I understand that that can help to some extent. But how much can like a community health center help there in place of something like an inpatient psychiatric unit?
I'm certainly, your caller definitely has a point. And most the community mental health center, for example, in Bennington, does have a kind of hospital diversion program, but there are a limited number of people that they can put in those beds, because funding is very limited. And some of those folks still are going to end up from time to time needing inpatient care. Yes, funding is extremely difficult to come by. Yes, there need to be more of those. As you, I think, said in the earlier part of this, that over the last year, Central Vermont's inpatient unit served 350 patients.
Yeah.
Where are those 350 patients going to go? They can't all be served by hospital diversion programs. Where are even half of those patients going to go? Yes, the more hospital diversion programs there are, the better it will take care of some of that. But it still isn't going to take care of enough of that.
We got this comment. A listener wrote in and said, I spent 17 days at the CVMC inpatient psychiatric unit in the summer of 2022, and it absolutely saved my life. And, you know, this was reflected by something that Carrie from Montpelier said earlier when she called. I am absolutely gutted that the psych ward closed and so worried about what I will do and where I will go if I need it again, as well as for everyone I met there and other Vermonters in need. Doctor, I have to wonder if, you know, when you hear people say something like, it absolutely saved my life, that is not just a throwaway line, right? I mean, getting to these places, you must have seen instances where you know this saved a life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've seen instances where it was not available and the life was gone. I've seen suicides that could have been prevented.
And when we're talking about that number, 350 people, let's say, that you know, seeking or needing the help or that capacity, are there also, is that number, can you imagine that it's underreported? In other words, people that may not know how to seek help, there may be people that are more in these kind of crises than we know.
Yes, not only is it underreported, it has other ramifications. Also in the news all the time is the substance abuse crisis.
Right.
The fact that there's a substance abuse crisis, this is not a personal failing of the people who are abusing substances. So many of them are self-medicating, and it's the only way they know how, and it's the only thing they have available because they can't access whether... because we're in a rural area and what is available is so far away, or it's just not available, period. So you see increasing amounts of self-medication. And unfortunately, there are also increasing deaths related to that.
What do you think is going on here? And I mean this in the big picture, because as I was talking with Lexi Krupp before about this, you know, somebody breaks their wrist, their leg. You know, it's something you can see. It's something a doctor can fix. It is different with mental health. It is a different challenge. I understand that. But do we undervalue the importance of mental health care in this country? And what can we do about it when things like this happen, when an inpatient psychiatric unit that so many people depend on in a certain area closes down?
That's a very, very large question. I know from a psychiatrist's point of view, and certainly I'm sure other people have the same point of view, part of the, yes, it's a national problem, part of the problem is that we don't like thinking about mental health issues. Everybody talks about stigma. Stigma is around those things which are uncomfortable to us. We're not uncomfortable with the fact that, heart disease, I believe, is still the number one killer of people in this country. And we're sort of used to the idea that, yes, as people get older, certainly they're going to get heart disease. And okay, so that might happen to me too. And yeah, I'm so glad there's a hospital and good doctors and all of that. We don't like to think about that we might be so many of us have mental health issues that need care and need serious care. And yet about 30% of the general population will at some point in their lives need serious care. When you think about the kinds of ailments that we all have, other than probably the common cold, the most common ailment every single human being has at some point in their lives is anxiety. There's nobody in this world who hasn't had anxiety.
You got that right.
Not to mention a few other things. You know, there's nobody in this world who doesn't at some point suffer grief and the ramifications of that. But we don't like to think about that. We like to put people in a corner of, oh, it's your personal weakness. It's your personal failing. So you go figure that out. We don't want to spend money on it.
Dr. Catapano-Friedman. I'm sorry. Go ahead. No, please finish up your thought.
I was just going to say, we want to spend money on preventing heart disease. And yes, we do. However, that's not as rampant as, for example, anxiety, which everybody experiences at some point.
I have to ask a personal and perhaps difficult question here. This must be very frustrating for you. As you've mentioned, when you first moved to the area, you know, there was so much more availability for this kind of care, and it's really dropped off so sharply now. Are you committed to staying in Bennington and helping people, at least in the short term?
And in the long term, I have been in Vermont for 34 years now. I have been a practicing psychiatrist for almost 43 years. My roots are very much here. I love what I do, frustrating and infuriating as the circumstances often are. And I tend to be a fix-it person. I'm going to do what I can, whatever I can, to fix this. I'm not inclined to run away from things. I love Vermont, so I'm not going anywhere. However, we need more people who do what I do, because I am not immortal either.
Right. Dr. Lisa Catapano-Friedman, the medical director at the Memory Clinic in Bennington and the president of the Vermont Psychiatric Association, thank you so much for sharing your time, your story with us, and for the work that you do. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
When people consider leading a good life, they're usually focused on happiness or perhaps finding purpose, making life more meaningful through acts of helping others. If you're lucky, perhaps you've found a path to both. But even if you have, our next guest argues there's a third component to the good life that's just as essential as the worthy pursuits of happiness and meaning, and that's what makes life interesting. What is it that makes life interesting? Well, that's just it, finding, exploring, and mastering the art of the interesting. And that's also the title of the book by Dr. Lorraine Besser called The Art of the Interesting, What We Miss in Our Pursuit of the Good Life and How to Cultivate It. Besser has a PhD in philosophy and is a professor at Middlebury College, and she joins me now to talk about why what's interesting can be a kind of third leg on a stool that helps achieve balance in leading a good life. Dr. Besser, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be here.
Love this book. I don't know if you'll disagree with this or not, but I refuse to call it a self-help book, even if that's the section someone puts it in a bookstore. It does offer a kind of guide to finding the so-called good life, but to me, this felt more like a book of philosophy for our times, and that makes sense. You are a philosopher. I'm curious how you would describe this book for potential readers.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's more than a self-help book, and it's got a lot of different philosophical basis. But it's really, I think it's a very unique book. What it is offering a vision for how to think about our presence in the world and how we go about living on a day-to-day basis.
Let's talk about happiness and meaning, which I mentioned in the intro here. These are terms that often pop up when people speak about living a good life. And while you're not dismissing either, you point out there are shortcomings to each. And first, let's examine happiness. You know, I had a great time covering this very topic last summer for an episode of Brave Little State. In doing so, it made me happy. But it's not like that feeling stayed with me all the way through then up until now. And that's something your book delves into, the fact that happiness, wonderful as it is fleeting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's our typical experiences of happiness. It's our state dominated by positive affect. And what we know about positive affect is that it's meant to function as a reward. So it's meant to help us do the things that keep us healthy and keep us thriving. And yet to function as a reward, it's got to go away. So now our experiences of happiness, right, that they're bound to be short-lived. We just can't stay up there forever.
And what about finding meaning and purpose in life? And that often involves devoting your time to helping others. And you have an example in the book of someone who was dedicated to that very worthy pursuit, but still felt a kind of void. I mean, what's missing in just seeking to find meaning or purpose in life?
Yeah, thanks. So I think about it in terms of saints and heroes, right? So saints are, you know, ones who are really focused on purpose, and they can be really rewarding, important purposes, of course. Yet when we get exclusively focused on the pursuit of purpose, meaning, achievement, what we do is really narrow our focus, and we end up cutting out a lot from our lives. So we really focus on what is important to get to our goals, and then everything else just kind of gets factored out. And that really prevents us from taking advantage of all that we can get.
We're going to get into the interesting now, and at the risk of alienating some younger listeners who may not have had the pleasure of following the fictional lives of a group of neurotic, self-centered, yet very funny characters from the hit 1990s TV show Seinfeld, I am really delighted you used that show as an example in your book. How did Larry David and the other writers of that show use the exploits of Jerry, George, Elaine, and Kramer to make a point about happiness and or the lack of it in life?
Yeah. So they created the happy dance, right? So, you know, you have this group of characters, right, in Seinfeld. We don't necessarily think about happiness when we think about them. But if you actually look at what they're doing when they're happy, they're embracing it and they're really living it in the moment. So they're doing happy dances when they're happy. And yet when it goes away, they're fine with it, right? And I think that's actually a real secret for how we can go about approaching happiness within our lives. take it when you got it, to do the happy dance, and yet to, you know, be okay when it goes.
I have to stick with this Seinfeld thing because I was a fan of the show, but I think that using it again in the book was such a great point to make. And I wonder if you'll agree with my take on this. I think despite the conventional wisdom that's even discussed within certain episodes that Seinfeld was a show about nothing, I'd argue it was really a show about everything because the characters found every little thing, for better or for worse, worthy of interest and discussion. There's one episode where Elaine complains to Jerry. She says, I can't spend the rest of my life coming into this stinking apartment every 10 minutes to pore over the excruciating minutiae of every single daily event. But whether it was talking about people who talk too softly or people who talk too close up or a zipper that gets stuck on a coat, even breaking up with a woman because she ate her peas with a fork one at a time off a plate, those are seemingly mundane things that became major topics of interest in the show. Is it too much of a stretch to say there is value in finding interest in even the tiniest things?
Oh, it's not a stretch at all. I really think that that is a great approach to this. We can find the interesting even in the smallest parts of our lives. And so just noticing these little details and picking up on them like the Seinfeld gang does, right? And they talk about them and they go back and forth and they follow their sense of interest. So we can really develop a lot of interesting experiences in life just by really considering the small things and engaging with them.
And what about that focusing in on what is interesting? Because your book does kind of provide a way to say that, you know, you can find the interesting, and it doesn't have to be something positive necessarily. You say that there are obstacles in life that people can use to help themselves if they find that obstacle interesting. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, thank you. So part of the research that this is stemming from has been research to show that these kinds of experiences are really different from happy experiences or meaningful ones. And one of the things that makes them different is that they're really often marked by the experience of complex emotions. And these are, you know, if we're focused on happiness, we tend to like run at the thought of a complex emotion or anything that might challenge us. Yet we know now that if we embrace the complex emotions, if we could approach challenges with this sense of interest, that we can really engage with those experiences in ways that will really impact ourselves. We often kind of change our perspective throughout this kind of engagement. And I think over time, it gives us a much better approach towards dealing with the challenges in life.
And are these things that you can share with other people, or is it something that you can pursue on your own if you can't get somebody to find something interesting that you find interesting?
Oh, yeah. You could do it within your own minds. You can do it with a conversation with somebody else. And it's really just about really discovering what it feels for you inside to have an interesting experience and then recognizing the situations where you have that and really just letting it go. So I think it's a great thing that we can develop in cases of solitude, right? Go out into the woods, look around, notice the small details. That'll generate some richness within your life. And also, but conversations, I think, are also another great model of it, right? If you're lucky enough to have someone you can just go back and forth with, right? Recognize how that feels, right? It's the same feeling throughout, and we can get it from so many different kinds of experiences.
I think that's what's wonderful about this book is that, again, it's something as simple as talking with your friend about a sports team, you know, and getting really into why is this team always breaking my heart, you know. It's interesting in a way that maybe somebody else wouldn't find interesting, but delving into that, it creates a kind of meaning that you may not even be aware of at the time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really important to pick up on, right? What we find interesting is completely dependent on us as individuals. And so we should embrace that and really gives us a signal to kind of harness it within our lives because we're not out searching for what is interesting. We should go about creating interesting experiences for ourselves.
Creating them, yes. That's part of what's interesting here, too. Did you go back to, you know, philosophers that you may have studied over time to find examples of interest or those philosophers who may have dug into what is interesting in life?
Yeah, you know, there's surprisingly not a lot of direct discussions about this. We find it in some discussions of aesthetics, right? And I think there's a real kind of model that. So Kant talks about aesthetics in a way where he describes this kind of way in which when you're considering a piece of art, right, it hits your mind and engages it in this very kind of distinctive way. And I think that's a nice point of connection if that's something that you experience often, right? It can be very similar to an aesthetic experience that really just like hits your mind and engages it. But we also just don't see a lot of philosophers in the past or even in the present talking about this. And it's a real new development within the past few years to understand this notion of the ways in which interesting experiences can enhance our lives. And it's long overdue for us to be talking about this.
Why do you think it's been overdue? Why do you think there was so much more, it seems like, an emphasis on again, the happiness, the meaning of life?
Yeah, you know, these are really two really important sources of goodness within our life. And there's a way in which our interest in them can get really focused on what they're about. And when we're so focused on what they're about, right, then we're just kind of overlooking stuff that's happening in our lives. And as part of this new research, you know, it's all about exploring this we call it a new dimension of the good life, but it's really not new, right? I mean, we're just picking up on aspects of people's lives that have been really rewarding for them for a long time. And what I'm hoping to do is to try to, you know, help us increase these kinds of experiences within our lives by labeling them, by understanding what they feel like, understanding how it is that we can bring our minds to our experiences in a way that will create interesting experiences.
And you also write, don't run from boredom. There can be, you can find the interesting within boredom.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, boredom is something that we are, you know, many of us like think about it, we hear, we're like, oh no. But I think that, you know, the experiences of boredom, if you really understand what's going on there, right, there are experiences where our mind is like trying to engage and it's just not. And so I think that we can really learn from that. And when we're experiencing boredom, kind of shift towards thinking about engagement techniques, right? So often we tend to alleviate boredom by like pulling up our phone or distracting us. And that's not really what our mind's seeking in those moments. It's seeking someplace to land and engage. And so I think we can really learn from those experiences about what it is that we need in the moment.
Yeah, your mind is telling you something, and it's not saying necessarily just blindly scroll through your phone. It's so much to delve into in this book, and so many really good strategies for overcoming boredom and making life basically more interesting. Dr. Lorraine Besser is the author of The Art of the Interesting, What We Miss in Our Pursuit of the Good Life and How to Cultivate It. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Yeah, thank you.